The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Acclaimed for her balanced, perceptive, thoroughly researched, and exceptionally well-written nonfiction portraits of historical figures, Stacy Schiff won the 2000 Pulitzer Prize for her biography, Vera, Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov, a narrative of the 52-year marriage of the legendary writer and his even more vivid wife. Her many honors include fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Her new book examines the life of Samuel Adams. A recent review in the Wall Street Journal calls the book a tour de force. She'll be joined in conversation this evening with Tracy Matisak, award-winning broadcaster and journalist. Please join me in welcoming our guests to the Free Library.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you all so much for being with us this evening. We hope that we will have an enlightening and engaging conversation. And as always, we have saved some time toward the end for your questions for Stacy. So if you've got a question, just jot it down and we'll have staff members with microphones to take your questions. So all of that said, Stacy Schiff, welcome back to the Free Library.
Thank you, Tracy.
It's a delight to have you back.
I'm loving the Stacy and Tracy show. So.
Yes. We've been laughing about
that
backstage.
It's never happened before.
We think we're going to take it on the road, actually. So, So Stacy, you have written about the Salem witch trials. You've written about Cleopatra. You've written about Ben Franklin. What drew you to Samuel Adams?
I'm going to try to reconstruct it as honestly as I can, but I feel as if there's something that the biographer never quite entirely is able to explain to herself. At a certain point, I realized that I knew pathetically little about Samuel Adams, and that that was particularly embarrassing because I come from Adams, Massachusetts. So the fact that, which my brother insisted was named for John Adams, erroneously. And so I started reading a little bit about what his contemporaries had had to say about Samuel Adams. And to a man, they say he is essentially the man of the hour. Thomas Jefferson calls him the most active, the earliest, most persevering patriot. John Adams will say the true history of the American Revolution can't be written without the character of Samuel Adams. So all of his contemporaries name him as the prime mover, and yet we know so little about him. So part of it, in a funny way, it was very much like Cleopatra, was trying to fill in the person behind a name that we all recognize, but about whom we knew so little. Yeah. And I was coming off of the Salem witch trials at this point, and I think I was probably consciously or not looking for someone admirable who stood up to power in a way that was very difficult for people in 1692 as the witch trials are sort of barreling forward, and it's very difficult to express skepticism of them because it's very dangerous. And finally, in the fall of 1692, a few extremely courageous people sort of raise their hands and say, wait, what's going on here? And so I think I was looking for that kind of moral fiber. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, 2016, we were all thinking, I think, a lot about democracy and what it meant. So some intersection of those things led me ultimately to sitting on the floor of the library reading about Samuel Adams, and at a certain point my agent said, well, clearly you want to write about Samuel Adams, you idiot. So that was, you know, that was where that ended up.
Well, and I was thinking about the timing of the book and how it lands in our hands at a time when democracy is hanging in the balance, and I wondered how much that was on your mind as you were writing the book, because you told me you started 2016, 17-ish.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a lie to say that wasn't on my mind. I think we've all been thinking in terms of fundamentals and what the country stands for and really where it comes from. And the part of this story that I think we tend to forget is how rough and tumble were the origins of American democracy. it's not a linear business. It proceeds in fits and starts. There are moments where the opposition move, the resistance just stalls out completely. There are sort of 3 years after the Boston Massacre when things go very quiet. Samuel Adams is really the only person who's still sort of egging things on. And it's very sharp elbow, rough and tumble backroom tactics. It's not a particularly, I mean, we very much have sanitized it. It's not a particularly elegant business, this revolution making stuff.
Yeah. You mentioned that he has been called many things, but you should not call him Sam.
Well, I guess we can call him Sam out of fondness, but historically he was always Samuel. I think at this point, since he's become a beer, we just have decided he's Sam Adams. It's very hard. I noticed there's a piece in the New Yorker this week about the book, and oddly enough, he's Samuel Adams on the cover of the magazine, and he's Sam Adams in the article. So even the fact checkers at the New Yorker seem to think he's Sam Adams.
Can you address the particular challenge, Stacey, of writing about someone who seemed to go out of his way to not leave much of a paper trail for historians?
I would love to. How much time do we have? This is the part where I want to make you all feel sorry for me. Part of the beauty of this piece of history is that it's so little known. And, of course, the reason it turns out to be so little known, I would now wager, is because it's really hard to document. So let me start with the reasons for that. Adams, first of all, when you're in the business of fomenting revolution, you tend to not leave too much of a trail. You're covering up your fingerprints. So perhaps the lines of this book that I had the most trouble writing were the description that we have from John Adams of sitting in Philadelphia at the Continental Congress as he watches Samuel Adams feed his papers to the fire. And then on another occasion, he watches Samuel Adams cutting them into smithereens and littering them out the window. So there's the historical record, basically. So Adams goes out of his way for various reasons to cover his trail. The paper trail is very much meanders, and there are big holes in it. And then there are certain things that just don't turn up. For example, one of the best documents we have about him is an account written by his great-grandson on the life of Samuel Adams. It's a little dry, but it's quite comprehensive. It's mostly accurate. And in a footnote, the great-grandson mentions a memoir about Adams by his daughter. So, of course, when I started the book, I assumed that 50 or 60-page memoir would be with his papers in the New York Public Library. It isn't there. So there, and I find this with every book, there's the sort of holy grail. So if anyone has that, I hope they might think of sending it my way at this point. So there were things like that that never turn up. And I suppose on the flip side of that, and this isn't exactly your question, the documentation in the British archives is quite extraordinary. Adams is running circles around crown officials. He's the nemesis of the royal governors of Massachusetts through these years. And they're all writing back to London, back to the ministry, in very eloquent and colorful terms about this public nuisance, Samuel Adams. So that turned out to be a treasure trove of material. Constructing a person's biography from what his enemies have to say, we should all remember this, I suppose, as a life lesson, is a dangerous business because that too can be very tenacious or very warped, but in this case, it was also very rich.
Yeah. So you write about how Jefferson and others viewed him as a father, if not the father, of the American Revolution, and yet so many of us, I think like you, did not know a great deal about him. For some reason, that perception didn't carry forward, and do you think it was because there weren't a lot of his writings around, or was there some other reason that he just has not really gotten his just due?
It's such a great question. I'm assuming that to some extent, when you want to build up a country after a revolution, you want to get rid, you want to sweep the revolutionaries off the stage. So that someone who is attached to the less antiseptic parts of the revolution, more of the street rioting parts of the revolution that you maybe don't want to remember when you're building up an established government, I think Adams gets swept aside with much of that. He's a very modest man. He's very, very unassuming and very recessive, very much given to kind of smoky back rooms. So he doesn't, he dismisses himself in a funny way. He's very complicit in the disappearance. John Adams will remind him late in life that the papers that Samuel Adams has written over the course of 40 years are crucial to an understanding of America, and that he should collect and publish them. And Samuel never takes the hint. He never does that. So, you know, you do have people who are writing for posterity, like John Adams particularly, who's been doing so since he was an adolescent. And then you have people who just think, well, posterity will take care of this, which is a sort of careless attitude, and into that school falls Samuel Adams.
And he,
I should just add that he's a very religious man, and my sense is that he only cared really about one judgment in the world. And he didn't care what posterity thought of him. He just, you know, cared about the ultimate judgment.
It's an audience of one.
Exactly. And that he's playing to that audience to a large extent.
Yeah. And to your point, he was an unlikely hero. In fact, you write that for the first 40 years of his life, he was a total failure. Can you describe what you mean by that? And then what happened at that point that sort of lit the fires of revolution under him?
What does it say about me that I find it deeply charming that he was a failure for 40 years? indeed. He comes from a very wealthy family. A family that is, and this is to your second question, that is ruined by an act of parliament, by a sort of peremptory, unexpected act of parliament, which may have some bearing on the years that will follow. So that when he goes to Harvard, he goes back to Harvard for a master's degree, and in the course of his earning his master's degree, his family goes from being quite affluent to being really bankrupted by this act of parliament. So he will leave Harvard, and he'll have a few jobs. For example, at one point he gets a job in an accounting firm, thanks to a friend of his father's, and he lasts for a very short time because the head of the firm notices that he can do nothing but think about politics. He can't seem to attend to his ledgers whatsoever. He's really only interested in politics. So he pretty much leaves that job quickly. He floats around. He's relatively aimless. He earns a bit of money as a tax collector in Boston in those years. He manages in some extraordinary way to run up a bill which is sort of 8 times bigger than any other tax collector. I mean, he just dives deeper and deeper into debt. He had some family money. He squanders that money. So really until for those first 40 years, he's very much a kind of aimless man about town. He knows everybody, but he accomplishes very little.
Yeah. And was there a defining moment? Was there something that just clicked that caused him at age 40-ish to all of a sudden really pursue liberty, revolution, to become one of the Sons of Liberty?
As somebody said in a review, you kind of want that they killed my dog moment. You know, this is what made him suddenly. He's very much, possibly because of this earlier intervention of Parliament, he's very much dismayed by the Sugar and the Stamp Acts, by this incursion of by this overreach, as he sees it, of British authority. And it is during the response to the Stamp Act that he becomes very central to various friends who are in the Massachusetts House of Representatives for whom he helps to write documents. And I should have said that he has spent some of these aimless years as a journalist, writing various things for various papers, all of it pseudonymously, so it's very difficult for us to actually figure out the paper trail of those years. But basically, the Stamp Act is what summons him from the wings to center stage, and it's in the course of the response to the Stamp Act that he will become a member of the Massachusetts House of Representatives.
And we discovered that he had a particular talent for inflaming passions, often, as you mentioned, under an assumed name, but sort of instigating this political upheaval and then disappearing into the shadows. Can you share maybe a couple of examples of how he did that? And I'm thinking, you know, Boston Tea Party, there's any number of examples where he just sort of got people riled up and then faded away.
Let me just talk first about the getting people riled up, because he has this amazing ability to unite men. And there's a lot of arm twisting here. There are a lot of people who aren't really sure what they think until they've talked to Samuel Adams, and then they seem to know exactly what they think. And he's extremely good at, for example, with John Hancock, who is a very wealthy younger man, not really sure of his political convictions, never really will be sure of his political convictions. Samuel Adams is tremendously effective in sort of roping John Hancock into the opposition party and keeping him there, for the most part. There are also years when the two of them are off speaking terms. But John Hancock, whom everyone else thinks of as sort of a political weather vane, when he's in the presence of Adams, is very much wed to the resistance. Sorry, what was the Boston Tea Party? So the Boston Tea Party is a fascinating case because we obviously don't know exactly who orchestrates the Tea Party. There's tremendous opposition, we can talk about this, to the arrival of the tea. To uncrate it is to essentially accede to British demands. Samuel Adams's great comment at this moment is, because I couldn't trust to the personal virtue of my fellow citizens to not drink the tea, I trust to their public virtue in rejecting the tea. So he and the other opposition leaders in Boston, the other radical leaders, have called this series of town meetings to decide what to do with the tea, how to oppose its landing. Essentially, they would like it to be sent directly back to London so that no one pays a duty or accedes to the Tea Act. A couple of weeks before the Boston Tea Party, Adams will write to his chief correspondent in London and say, you know, unless something is done at your end, I'm going to have some news about a non-trifling event. So, you know, this pretty heavy hint that, you know, something is up. And we have various hints. We know from people who were later deposed in London that Adams is very active in the tea meetings. When the group of men go off to the harbor, to the wharf, to actually pull up the crates, the chests of tea, and splinter them open and dump everything overboard, Adams and John Hancock and Thomas Young and a few other leaders are very conspicuously not there. They're very conspicuously still at the Old South Meeting House, which is somewhat telling in and of itself. And afterwards, Thomas Hutchinson, the royal governor, will say, Adams was never in greater glory than he was that morning, that evening. So, you know, there are all of these hints that he's, as the deposed witnesses will say, at the top of the list of suspects. But we certainly don't have his word for it. He writes about the Tea Party later in this completely passive tense. It's as if the tea crates just jumped overboard. No person was involved. Because he's very intent on making this about principals rather than perpetrators. Yeah. So there's really, and everyone, you know, everyone in Boston goes, it's an astonishing thing. Thousands of people have watched this event. Everyone is very clear about the fact that 342 chests of tea have been dumped overboard. It's something like 90,000 pounds of tea. But nobody has any idea who could have done it. There's not a single, and when Boston wants to go silent, Boston can go silent. So no names were ever mentioned.
So you mentioned Thomas Hutchinson, who was the loyalist governor of Massachusetts, and of course Samuel Adams was an absolute thorn in his side. Depending on who you asked at the time, Samuel Adams was either a man of, and I'm quoting here, refined policy, steadfast integrity, exquisite humanity, and universal good character, or he was, as Hutchinson might have said, the Machiavelli of chaos. And I'm wondering, as you researched his life and read what people wrote about him, was the truth somewhere in the middle, or where did you come down on who he really was in all of this?
Well, I think that most of us come closer to the Machiavelli of chaos piece of it, right? We think of him as a firebrand or sort of a brawling radical in some way. I was surprised by how many descriptions there were, and that's a John Adams description, of how refined and affable and charming and just generally genteel he was. And he loved children, he sang to children, he was lovely with his own children, he entertained, you know, beautifully at his incredibly Spartan home. There are lots of tributes to what a lovely man he is, what a decorous individual he was. So I think the answer to your question is both of the above, but I was fascinated to see that there was that dichotomy, and obviously the descriptions of him as the Machiavelli of chaos always come from the crown officers whom he has so tortured for years.
And of course, for all of those efforts, he did in fact become public enemy number one, in the eyes of the crown, at least in the British government, and in fact, if things had gone just a little bit differently in April of 1775, we might not even be sitting here talking about him.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that is what I should have mentioned. That was another part of the genesis of the book. I was sitting at my desk one day, reading Paul Revere's accounts, as one does, and I suddenly realized, wait a minute, we all know that Paul Revere got on his horse on April 18th, 1775, and rode off, but I'd never really thought about where he was going. And I think where was he going? He was actually going to warn John Hancock and Samuel Adams mm-hmm. that they were likely to be arrested. That was the understanding of where the British troops were going that night, which may have been erroneous, in fact, but that was his mission. And it was at that moment that I thought, and that's when I knew the book started also with Paul Revere's ride, just because it seemed so crazy that we all know this, but we never really think about where is he riding at yeah. that moment. So yes, Hancock and Adams are at this point. They have adjourned a provincial congress. They're about to ride to Philadelphia for the Continental Congress. They have realized that they may be in some danger of arrest. They are the two proscribed traitors at this point, and they're in Lexington, at the home of the Reverend of the Lexington minister, who is related to John Hancock. And so they're in this house. They get several warnings that evening that they're very likely about to be arrested or assassinated, as some people assumed. And then apparently there's a scuffle between the two of them. John Hancock thinks that he should stand and fight, a man who's with no military background. And Samuel Adams has to keep reminding him that their place is actually on the political side of things, not the military mm-hmm. side of things. And finally, after many hours and a second warning from Paul Revere, the two of them scuttle off.
Yeah. And Paul Revere gets in trouble that night himself.
The only person who ends up with a gun pointed at his head that night is Paul Revere, exactly, who rides into a British ambush after the first warning. He rides off meaning to warn more households of what's about to happen. And he meets with a British ambush. And he's just, it's an amazing account which we have from him. He's unflappable. I mean, they're really trying. They're toying with him. They're insulting him as they ride. They take his horse. And he's just so cool. Yeah. And they say to him, you have to tell us the truth. There's a gun pointed to your head. And he basically says, I understand. Thank you so much. And he's just completely in his element. But then he returns to the parsonage. He's shocked to find Adams and Hancock still there, not having moved. And because he's able to say to them, I had this British patrol with me, less than a mile from the house. You really need to get out of here. And it's at that point that the two of them trundle off.
Speaking of Paul Revere, I was struck by the notion that the more things change, the more they stay the same. And by that, I mean that I was thinking about how after the Boston Massacre, Samuel Adams and Paul Revere really sort of commandeered the narrative about what happened on that night. And so they painted a picture in words and images of the colonists being, completely unarmed, innocent victims, and then there were the bloodthirsty British soldiers on the other side who attacked them completely unprovoked. And I couldn't help but think of the kind of the disinformation campaigns that we see even today.
This is a hard thing to get one's mind around. That, first of all, the word misinformation existed at the time, which I find, kind of amazing. Yes, Adams is a master of propaganda and a master at misinformation. And certainly the best instance of that is after the Boston Massacre, a confrontation that, for all we know, was provoked. I mean, seems from much of the testimony to have been provoked by the townspeople who are heckling and insulting and essentially egging on the British guards mm-hmm. who ultimately fire on them. Adams does everything he can after the massacre to see that the trial takes place as soon as possible while the town is still inflamed, while the town is still furious, while there are still spots of blood in the streets. Yeah. And he and Hutchinson basically face off at that moment. And Hutchinson wants to delay the trial, obviously, so mm-hmm. he can get a fair trial. And he'll prevail over Adams. And there are some kind of dicey moments with Adams. At one point, he kind of barges into court and tries to talk some of the justices who are meant to serve at the trial into delaying. Mm-hmm. Into not delaying. The trial takes place in the fall. Boston Massacre had been in March. The trial takes place in October because Thomas Hutchinson got his way. And everyone but two of the British soldiers are exonerated, which does not stop Adams for the next 6 months from relitigating the entire incident in the press. Almost weekly, there's a piece by him, usually on the front page, usually as Vindex, which is one of his many pseudonyms, in which he essentially retries the entire case, casts aspersions on the witnesses, says how can the jury know what they were talking about, they're not even Bostonians, casts aspersions even on one of the victims who had on his deathbed had said, I understand why the soldiers fired on me, and Adams basically says, how can you believe him, he was a Catholic. I mean, it's extraordinary stuff. And at one point he's challenged by the Attorney General, also writing under a pseudonym, who basically says something to the effect of, are you really going to say that you know, two judges and 24 jurors didn't know what they were talking about, but you do? And the answer to that is basically yes, that was what he was trying to say.
And didn't John Adams defend the soldiers who were tried?
Yeah, and that, I mean, that must have been a really interesting conversation. John Adams, I don't think, would have accepted the case without Samuel having had something to do with it. There was an enormous incentive at that point for Boston to prove, for New England to prove that justice, that it knew how to adjudicate a case, how that justice should be served, that this could be dealt with in a very sophisticated way, and for nobody to release any Boston secrets. And John Adams could be trusted to do both of those things. But there must have been some very interesting conversations between the cousins at that point.
Well, and I was struck, too, by something that you wrote at the very beginning of the book about Samuel Adams and his idealism. And you said, and I'm going to quote here, that he believed that a moral people would elect moral leaders. He believed virtue to be the soul of democracy. To have a villainous leader imposed on you was a misfortune. To elect him yourself was a disgrace. And I'm wondering, I have two questions here. One is, what do you think he would make of American politics today, for starters?
I think you just said it. Yes.
And I guess I was also struck by the high value that he placed on virtue, and yet he was willing to resort to less than virtuous means to shape public opinion at the time, sometimes to radicalize people. And I wonder how you sort of square that high value on virtue and yet the willingness to do some underhanded things maybe to accomplish your ends.
I think that's the charm of the man. I mean, it is such an extraordinary duality that he does, both of these things are true. He's incredibly noble, and at the same time, he's incredibly underhanded. And I guess the part about that that I find so interesting is that from the point of view of the Crown officials, and particularly of Thomas Hutchinson, none of them looked at Samuel Adams and saw the idealism that I think we see when we look at him and when we read him, because all they saw was a disappointed, penniless layabout. I mean, no poor man could have had such a high set of high ideals was essentially the way Hutchinson saw it. And interestingly, I think the way Adams saw it was no rich man could have had such, you know, such high principles. But they're unable to remember that he's actually kind of downwardly mobile, that he's from an affluent background, that he, you know, is not just a poor, penniless, disappointed desperado, which is how they see him through these years. But the tactics are really subtle and sometimes almost thrilling. I mean, here's an example. After the Boston Tea Party, when Boston is trying to debate, Boston knows that a punishment of some kind is probably going to come its way. Not everybody is really thrilled that those 342 crates of tea went overboard. And so there are meeting after meeting about how are we going to deal with this, what should our response really be. And at the same time, there's this question of should the colonies actually be discussing this among themselves? There's really no colonial union until this point. And Adams essentially commandeers the meeting that was meant to be discussing how Boston would reimburse the East India Company for the tea. And he sort of organizes another committee, which meets separately from that committee after that committee disbands. And he makes sure that the one person whom he knows is going to object to this just isn't in the room. He says, you know, it's awfully hot. I think we'll adjourn for the day. And then he and his secret committee go off, and they discuss a Continental Congress. And then ultimately they send this poor, beleaguered Taunton lawyer off, you know, home so he can litigate some cases, and in his absence they vote to hold a Continental Congress and to send a delegation. So, you know, there's just this extraordinary, you know, strategy behind the scenes at which he seems ridiculously skilled.
Well, so you mentioned a moment ago about him being sort of downwardly mobile, and I saw your piece today, your opinion piece in the Washington Post, where you talked about...
Well, that came out like an hour ago. You are very fast.
Paying attention over here. And you wrote about how this idea of, you know, blasting elites goes all the way back. I mean, we think it's something that we're seeing in our day and age, the sort of conflict between elites and those who might be perceived like a Samuel Adams, or to use the term, the basket of deplorables, right? We've got these opposite extremes. And you say that really this is not anything new.
Well, you know, it took me a long time to see this, that that all of the Adamses, both John Adams and Samuel Adams, and many other people, Mercy Otis Warren, many people who are writing during these years, absolutely abhor Thomas Hutchinson, who's a very sober, diligent, modest, you know, public servant, and but happens to hold almost all the high offices in Massachusetts himself. And the ones he doesn't hold, he's given to family members. So you have this very tight oligarchy that Adams and his friends turn into sort of the face of tyranny and use as a means, almost a sort of representation of the kind of tyranny that they're talking about abroad. So that this sort of homegrown despotism, which they imply is very corrupt and very colluding and very self-serving, which it probably isn't, is in some way in league with the tyranny from abroad. Mm. And they use that to tremendous effect. I mean, I think I call it the bouillon cube in the roiling water. I mean, it's a very tempting thing to be able to put a face to that kind of threat.
Yeah. What was Adams' position on slavery?
He can't abide it. And we know this because at his second marriage, his first mother-in-law gives the couple as a wedding present a slave, which was a New England custom of some sorts at the time among people who could afford it. And Adams balks at the idea and says, I will not have a slave in my house. She can come if she's free. And Sirius, her name was, came to live with the Adamses for decades. And actually, none of the letters from Philadelphia to Boston that he writes his wife fails to include a question of how is Surrey doing. I mean, she's clearly a very close member of the family. And there are a couple of aborted attempts in the 1760s to do something with abolition in Massachusetts. There are all kinds of petitions afoot. And he's very involved with that, but nothing ever comes of any of them.
Yeah. Samuel Adams did as much as anyone, and more than most, to inspire the American Revolution. But to your point earlier, after the war, he, I won't say faded from view, but he was not as prominent, right? Like, there was a period of years where he was really, you know, that guy. And then not so much after the war. And you talked about the idea of sort of sweeping the revolutionaries under the rug. And I'd like you to expand a little bit more on that and kind of what happened to him afterwards and what did his life look like?
It's a very sort of unsatisfying third act in the life. He's very good. He seems to be better at disassembling things than at building them up. So that after the war, when it's time to actually build institutions and pull the colonies together and confederate in some way, he's nowhere at the table, basically. He's very much at odds with the Federalists. He seems, in a funny way, to wish that the country could go back in time. I think he's still aiming for, you know, the pure democratic, the pure and pious democracy that he had first envisioned. So he has no real place at that table. He several times throws in his hat for political office, and he's soundly defeated. I mean, he's really seen as a relic, you know, very quickly after the revolution. When aspiring revolutionaries from elsewhere stop in Boston, they always, Adams is their first port of call. He's kind of the first revolutionary address. And he's really at odds with Hancock through many of those years. Hancock then, I think, nine times becomes governor of Massachusetts, and with each of his inaugurations, Adams just moves more and more into the background. And then he sort of outlives his age, really. He dies He dies in his 80s and very much forgotten.
A couple of things. As you were researching his life, what either surprised you the most about him or what would you say was the biggest takeaway from his life for you?
You know, he's very clear in his conviction that ordinary people can change the course of events. And he's rousing and thrilling, I think, on that front. So I think that was one of the biggest attractions and one of the biggest takeaways. And the other, I think, is just how truly rough and tumble and you know, helter-skelter in a funny way these years are. There's no straight path to, I think, unlike what many of us assumed from, you know, our school days, there's no straight path through the revolution. There really are all of these fits and starts and nooks and eddies. And there he is kind of at every turn, often the only one who's persevering through them, even when everyone else has kind of given up hope or decided that they can live with colonial restraint or colonial legislation. He's the one who's continually still at the tiller, saying, "No, we're at the tiller. We're saying we're not going. We're not going to live with this."
Yeah, I wasn't aware of this at the time that it happened, but in 2014, I'm sure you know, there were some workers that were fixing a leak at the Massachusetts State House, and they discovered a time capsule that had been buried in 1795. I think it was embedded into the cornerstone of the building, and it was by none other than Samuel Adams and Paul Revere. And I made some notes about it because I wondered if you were aware of this. But it seems that there were some newspapers in there. There was a shilling or two, I want to say, and a couple of other items. And I don't know what the dates of the newspapers were, but I just thought it was fascinating that after all of this time, they found it in, I think it was 2014, just fixing a leak or something.
Do you think that that memoir by his daughter is in there too? Now I suddenly understand why it has never surfaced. I'm going to Boston tomorrow. You can be certain I'm going
to
ask this
capsule.
Question before I get out of the airport. Exactly. I didn't know that. That's astonishing.
Yeah, that was news to me as well. Apparently at the time it made the papers, but I was surprised to hear it. And there were several newspapers that were apparently in remarkably good condition. And a couple of shillings and some other artifacts that the two of them put there in the Massachusetts State House, 1795.
I was just actually writing about Adams and Hancock because it's such an oddball relationship. I mean, they're completely unsuited to be friends and colleagues. And there's a very poignant moment when Hancock dies very young. Hancock dies at 56. Mm. And very much beloved by Boston. He's very rich, and he's given Boston church bells and trees and all kinds of things. So he's the sort of, you know, Boston's greatest philanthropist, and there's this immense and very spectacular funeral procession for him, which is led by Samuel Adams, who can't quite make it to the burying ground because he's at this point so feeble, and he has to be sort of held up and then carted home. And it's exactly the way the relationship sort of peters out at that point.
Well, on that note, let's take some questions from our audience for Stacy Schiff. It looks like we've got a question right here.
Thank you. I look forward to reading it. I've been reading the one about Franklin in Paris, and brings to mind, I mean, I know that Sam Adams sided with Jefferson in the conflicts with his cousin, with John Adams, and John Adams was very unsympathetic to the French Revolution, and I gather Sam was sympathetic to the French Revolution. And where does he fall in with the Girondists and the Jacobins and, if at all, Tom Paine and so forth?
He has a very vexed relationship with Paine, largely because he can't abide Paine's stance on religion. He thinks, obviously, that Paine is, you know, irreverent and uncomprehending in terms of religion. It's very hard to say what he makes of the French Revolution because the papers from those years are so sparse. I hate that. With Jefferson, it's really interesting because Jefferson's second inaugural address, he writes, or so he says, as a letter to Samuel Adams. And he writes this very moving letter to Adams, Jefferson, in which he says, you know, my dear friend, I hope you heard that as it was intended, which was as a letter to you. And it's really, he thinks of Adams as the embodiment of the Republican spirit. And it's a beautiful, I mean, it's kind of tears to the eyes kind of letter, because you don't exactly see, you know, brawling, radical, firebrand Samuel Adams behind those honeyed words. I mean, it's a very, you know, it's a beautiful speech. It's also a somewhat manipulative speech, if you believe Joe Ellis, who thinks he's, you know, Jefferson's basically doing this for political reasons. But it's one of these sort of rousing anthems to Republican values, because Jefferson sees Adams as representative of that in a way that John Adams no longer is. I mean, John and Samuel do pretty much go their separate ways, one of them believing, you know, in the rights of individuals more over anything else, and the other one really believing in institutions. And Samuel just really didn't get institutions.
Hi, thanks for coming all the way to Philadelphia.
It's an hour. Happy to do it.
So I think I know your answer to this question. You were talking about the misinformation that Sam Adams used, and so you sort of think of it kind of as an instrumental way of creating the revolution or sparking the revolution. There's a whole lot of American historiography that thinks of the revolutionaries as totally wacky, that they are simply the kind of people we would think of today as conspiracy theorists, and that they imagine that the British monarchy and government is a tyranny, whereas, in fact, it's almost impossible to figure out how they got there and it sort of brought Bolingbroke over to the United States and that whole thing. What was your sense as you were reading about these people? Were they in fact wacky? And if so, how did they get that way? That's a kind of a big mystery.
That's such a great question. Two things I should have mentioned earlier. Adams, when I say master propagandist, he writes under at least 30, if not more, pseudonyms. So we know a lot of what he writes, but a lot of what he writes we probably haven't figured out yet. And I assume somebody will, you know, one day by computer figure all of this out. Largely for those first years, the Crown officers tend to think that whatever this thing is that's so annoying these, you know, crazy radicals is delusion. And they're under some kind of crazy spell, and they'll snap out of it in a minute. They literally compare it over and over to the Salem witch trial, to Salem. They keep saying, you know, what is wrong with these guys? We don't get it. And they then begin to say, wait, there's a conspiracy among the radicals. What's fascinating is both sides accuse the other of conspiracy, exactly. So the radicals are essentially saying they're colluding in some conspiratorial way against American interests. They're going to be extortionate with us. Once they tax our, you know, our stamps, then they'll tax our land. What are they not going to tax once they start down this road? There is no conspiracy in Great Britain, and there is no conspiracy in America, but both sides are absolutely dead set on this conviction. What there is a very, and which I do think I feel very secure saying, is there's a deep and abiding irritation with British overreach, with this idea that an island should be administering a continent, that people are making demands of them. I mean, as Adam says at one point, why should you tax us? Our governments are identical. Why don't we tax you? I mean, there's just this sense of sort of, why are you toying with us like this? We have as much say in Parliament as we do over, you know, over the Emperor of China. I mean, there's just this complete befuddlement about why suddenly Great Britain has woken up and decided to attempt to regulate colonial trade. I mean, that had never been part of the bargain before. Why should that happen now? And what's interesting is that, well, two things are interesting. The level of ignorance in Great Britain of what was happening in the colonies and of what the colonies consisted is staggering. I mean, most people don't know where the colonies are. They may be in the West Indies. They might be in the East Indies. Nobody's really certain. And the Americans are aware of that. They're aware of the condescension, and they're aware of the real ignorance. But the other thing that's kind of staggering, and I'm sure people have written about this, but I've not seen it, is how vague the Massachusetts Charter really was. There's no mention of Parliament in the Massachusetts Charter. Over and over, Adams will go back to that, and as will some of his colleagues, and say, but wait a minute, why should we be listening to Parliament? No one has ever said that we are subordinate to Parliament. Yes, you know, we consent to a relationship with the king, but not to Parliament. And that vagueness is something that nobody had ever really looked at. And even Thomas Hutchinson, when the Stamp Act first passes, objects and says, you know, this is killing the golden goose. This is a really bad idea. The colonies can't afford this kind of a tax. But no one has really sort of said, you know, if we had maybe thought about this document and been a little bit, and delineated it a little bit better, we wouldn't be in this jam right now.
My question is, I'm just wondering if you could comment on your perspective on Adams's influence and in the dynamics of what happened at the First Continental Congress.
You know, this is one of those moments where you just have so many questions. As you know, there are no papers, really. No one's allowed to be reporting on what's happening. So we're limited, really, to the few sets of correspondence that we have that come out of those days. And what we largely have are people sort of saying, you know, we have people like Galloway saying, you know, this is a man who ate little, slept little, and thought much. And he says that in the most insulting possible way, you know, that Adams was everywhere he could possibly be, annoying everybody. And there's clearly a lot of backroom negotiating going on. At that Congress, as you know, there's an alarm. Word comes falsely from Boston that there's been an attack on the town of Boston. And just after that alarm, comes from Massachusetts, the Suffolk Resolves, which is the most strict non-importation agreement ever hobbled together, which had been largely agreed upon before the Adamses and the whole delegation left Massachusetts. People will go so far as to imply that Samuel Adams had arranged the false alarm so that people would sign the Suffolk Resolves. I don't think his degree of manipulation was that great. But I do think there was a lot of, you know, drumming up concern for poor martyred Boston. I mean, the thing that really pulls the colonies together in these years is not the Boston Tea Party, it's the punishment for the Boston Tea Party, right? It's the Boston Port Act. And at that point, it's fairly easy to get the other colonies on board, thanks to the Committees of Correspondence, which we didn't talk about, but Samuel Adams's invention, which tied together all the towns and all the colonies. And he's very instrumental at sort of drumming up that kind of unanimity at that Congress. I wish we had more. I mean, that's, yeah.
Hi, my question has two parts. One is, I'm wondering if another reason why Samuel Adams kind of faded after the Revolution was that he didn't get involved with the federal government as Washington, John Adams, Jefferson, and Madison, Hamilton all did. And then an exception is Franklin, but he was already famous with the lightning rod even before the Revolution. And the second part of my question is, since Samuel Adams did kind of retreat and just be involved with Massachusetts politics, what were things like when he was governor of Massachusetts, and did he keep some contact with the other ones that were more involved with the federal government?
Sorry, the first part of the question is Washington. Oh, of what happens to him after, in those first years in Boston? I'm sorry, was that the first part of the question? Doesn't play a role. You're absolutely right. Because he does not hold federal office, indeed contributes to the fact that he disappears somewhat from the scene. Added to that is the fact that John Hancock has gone back to Boston and has maligned Samuel Adams day and night, as have several other people, some of them on foreign payrolls, in fact, to somewhat neutralize his influence. And one of the rumors that John Hancock will spread is that Adams has been complicit in the Conway cabal against George Washington. So that also makes him persona non grata among the power elite, because many people believe that because Hancock has been running around saying it to everybody. So that works to his disfavor. He does briefly become governor of Massachusetts. He's lieutenant governor when John Hancock dies, and then he ascends to the governorship. And another historian has pointed out that the higher Adams went in the hierarchy, the worst he seemed to perform. He was a terrible governor. And I think he would have been a terrible, I think he would just have been a terrible administrator. I mean, all of those backroom tactics didn't really serve. All of the bringing men together was something that sort of somehow seemed to desert him after the Revolution. He ends up backing the wrong horse. He believes people who were very shady, believes in people who are very shady characters. He seems to get involved in all kinds of confusing imbroglios. It's almost as if he loses his gift in those years.
Well, I'm curious, Stacey, about your creative process and what it's like to, I mean, your book is so meticulously researched, as they all are. What is the process like for you to bring forth a book like this?
You know, you live under a rock for 5 or 6 years. I usually start with the primary materials. In this case, the papers of Samuel Adams, very fortunately for me, are in the New York Public Library. It's the first time I've actually lived in the city where the papers that I needed were housed. And what's wonderful with those papers is that his correspondence has been largely published, not entirely, but largely. But in the New York Public Library collection is the other side of the correspondence. So you begin to flesh out. I mean, you begin to see how people are writing to him. I mean, there are charming little things in there. There's a letter in the 1770s from another Samuel Adams on the Cape, who basically writes to Samuel Adams and says, I'm honored to share your name because you're such an amazing patriot, but it's very dangerous to be called Samuel Adams. And they're just such, a friend who writes to him when Adams is at the Continental Congress and the British have occupied Boston, and writes and says, I stopped at your house today and I carted off all the papers so that those vultures would have not have anything of yours to prey upon. And your testimony there to often how popular he was. Yeah. There's a wonderful story about him going to the Continental Congress for the first time. And as I say, he was very poor. He was generally bedraggled. He refers to himself as shabbily dressed. And clearly that didn't sit well with his constituents in Massachusetts. So over the course of several evenings, arrives at his house a tailor and a wig maker and a shoemaker, each of them dispatched by some mysterious benefactor. And they each take Samuel Adams's measure. And then at the end of the week or the month, appears at the doorstep a trunk with a full wardrobe for him to wear in Philadelphia. But that's mentioned in a letter of someone's as testimony to his popularity, that he could invoke this kind of tribute from people. And probably, by the way, it was John Hancock who paid for that, but we'll never know, unless those papers turn up in the time capsule.
Right?
so that was really where I started. I started with those papers, and then I generally tend to roam out to the secondary sources, and in this case, to the British Archives, which are not an hour from New York, unfortunately. And then there's a great deal in the Massachusetts Historical Society. There are Thomas Hutchinson's letters. There's a lot of John Adams material, a lot of the supporting cast. The newspapers, and that's the problem with someone who writes under 30 pseudonyms, and in a town that you want to really be able to paint the gritty detail of, you end up reading a lot of 18th century newsprint. So that was a little rough, but I can tell you precisely what was sold and for how much in Boston in 1768, if anybody ever wants to know. And then I usually go back from there to the primary sources, to Adams's papers, which I then can read again, in context. Mm-hmm. And only at the end of that do I start writing.
Wow. And then the writing process itself, I mean, that's got to take an awfully long time, I would think.
The writing usually takes about a year and a half when I don't really like to leave my office. I feel kind of as if I have a patient on the operating table, and if I leave, you know, could something terrible could happen before I got back. So I ruin a lot of family vacations. Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Other questions for Stacey? Yes.
Just carrying forward with your writing process. You go to these various places, libraries, organizations, whatever, you read, you transcribe onto paper or to a computer excerpts from what you read, I would assume. Without having written the book, what do you do with all these pieces that you've collected over a course of a year or two, whatever, and how do you, in your mind, how do you organize this and eventually get a book?
How much longer do we have? I have the most ill-organized and embarrassing process. But the answer to your question is that I take notes on a computer, and generally, only because I always remember where I read it, I will keep them organized in my computer by the archive. So there's a Massachusetts Historical, the 2019 trip, the 2020 trip, there's the British Archives trip, there's the Parliamentary Archives trip, they're all in separate files. When I'm ready to write a section of the book, and I know that there are better ways to do this, but I can't seem to do them. When I'm ready to write a section of the book, I generally read through most of my material and pull together what I think I'm going to want to use for that particular section. So, for example, the book opens, after an introductory chapter, the book opens with Paul Revere's ride, and that night, that April ride, I go through everything to see what I have that I think I'm going to want to pull into that chapter. And I make a sort of ur-text of those materials, and then I write from the ur-text. So I may have a 50-page or an 80-page document, which essentially has all the raw material for a particular section. And sometimes that source material will end up sort of spawning a child. In other words, I'll be in the middle of writing about the Boston Tea Party, and I realize I have to, or here's a better example. I had started down the road with the witchcraft book, and witchcraft symptoms have broken out, and everyone's in an uproar, and fingers are beginning to be pointed in all directions, but I have not yet told the reader what a witch is, or what a New Englander in the 17th century believed a witch to be. So I realized I had to go back and, first of all, do a kind of short history of witchcraft, and then pull that from all of my various source material and write a section which was basically, you know, when we say witch, what do we mean, and what did a 17th century villager in Massachusetts mean at the time? So the answer to your question is it's super unscientific and very cumbersome, but it seems to work because when you pull that material all together, it does begin to ferment in some way, and themes begin to emerge and chronologies begin to emerge. And I also keep a chronology usually, kind of bound chronology, because when you start seeing how things crisscross temporally, you see connections you wouldn't otherwise see. For example, there's a period in time where Thomas Hutchinson is writing a lot of letters because he's clearly addled. And I don't think I would have noticed the reason for that if I hadn't seen what was going on at the same time that he has this kind of epic letter writing season.
We have time for one last question.
Well, I have to slip in two, but they'll be very quick. You've mentioned Paul Revere's ride, and I'm sorry I haven't read your book yet. And maybe you can clarify a point on this, because a few years ago I read David Hackett Fisher's book, Paul Revere's ride. And I understood that ride to be part of a series of powder alarms because the colonists were collecting gunpowder and they were afraid the British were going to do raids. And this was not the first raid. There had been one in New Hampshire before that. So was it part of that? And my second question is much simpler. Are there particular historians of the colonial and revolutionary period that you admire and recommend?
They're both lovely questions. Paul Revere that night is sent out specifically. All of Boston has been on the alert and watching to see what the British are up to. And everyone has noticed that they're preparing something which doesn't look like anything they've seen before. But for days already, it has been clear that whatever that thing is, it's afoot. And Revere has already once ridden out to Lexington to discuss what kind of preparations they should make. And probably it's on that earlier visit with Hancock and Adams that they come up with the system of the lights, of the lanterns. There had indeed been earlier raids. General Gage is trapped in Boston at this point. He's realizing suddenly that he holds Boston, but he doesn't hold the Massachusetts countryside. And he's trying very hard to kind of both exercise his men a little bit. They're all moldering in Boston, and to try to somehow bring some of the supplies that he knows the colonists have been stockpiling back into Boston to get it out of colonial hands. And he's been less than successful in those previous two attempts. On this particular night, there's a slight bifurcation in the orders. His orders from London are to arrest Hancock and Adams. That is not what he orders his men to do, however. He orders them to go capture the munitions in Concord. And we don't know, was there a second order? Was there a verbal order? Why did Gage not follow what his orders were that night? And it's just unclear. But Revere is specifically sent out by Dr. Warren to warn Adams and Hancock that they are either going to be arrested or killed. And obviously, as we know, he alerts the countryside. When I have questions about something like that, the person I call is Joe Ellis, and I think he would be my answer to your question about someone who writes impeccably, deliciously, and with enormous energy about these years. And his latest book was called The Cause. He was the person who, when I'm really stuck, I call, or who occasionally, just when I think I can't do it anymore, calls and says, "How's that chapter coming?" But he's immensely learned, not only in the details, but particularly, I think, in the personalities. And so, you know, he and I have had conversations about Thomas Jefferson that made it seem as if we had both had breakfast that morning with Thomas Jefferson. But he had a probably better understanding of breakfast than did I. I would say he's been the person who's been who has really sort of made this material come alive the most for me.
Well, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Stacy Schiff for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.